This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
Project Room Key, Governor Gavin Newsom's initiative that turned hotel and motel rooms across the state into temporary shelters for the homeless during the height of the COVID pandemic, is now the subject of an independent evaluation. The goal of this report is to figure out if Project Room Key was successful in providing the protection and services it promised. What did it get right? What did it get wrong? And is there a way to take the lessons learned and apply them to today? Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Mary Hughes. We're going to start our conversation by taking a closer look at the findings of this evaluation with Nicole Fiore, Principal Associate with the research firm Apt Global and co-author of the report. Nicole, thank you so much for coming on to In-Depth and being a part of this conversation.
Absolutely.
So what was behind this evaluation of Project Room Key? Was this something that came from organizations in California, from the governor's office here? Where did this evaluation stem from?
So what we were looking at here is really understanding the experiences of people who participated in Project Room Key, also known as PRK, the experience of homeless service providers and local communities, city governments, county governments, in really standing up this program during a really complex time in our country and worldwide during the COVID-19 pandemic. So as this program was underway, two funders, the California Healthcare Foundation, as well as the Conrad and Hilton Foundation, came together to fund an evaluation to specifically look at PRK. We also partnered with the California Department of Social Services, who was the holder of the program within the California state government, on this evaluation.
Okay. And it seems like what you and other researchers who are part of looking at Project Room Key was that overall it was considered a success. So what are some of the key findings that got you and the others to this conclusion?
So there's three big reasons why we think, as the evaluation team, thought PRK was successful statewide. So number one, PRK brought people in from unsheltered homelessness, from other sheltered homelessness settings, indoors. So people who traditionally might not want to have gone to the congregate traditional shelters in their community came indoors with PRK. And this is a really big point. And why is this important? It's because that for so many years, especially for people who have experienced unsheltered homelessness, they're often called service resistant, meaning they don't want to come indoors. They don't want to take up offers of service. PRK discredited that thought, meaning that PRK demonstrated that when people are offered autonomy, privacy, and safety, and their priorities are recognized, meaning that they want to stay with their partners, their pets, their possessions, they will come indoors. Let's remember, PRK was often utilizing hotels and motels across California to bring people who were experiencing homelessness, who were highly vulnerable to COVID-19 and the outcomes of COVID-19, indoors. So they were offered hotel and motel rooms. They were offered healthcare services on site, three meals a day. There were supportive services such as case management on site. That was kind of the package, the model of PRK. So the first big reason was really getting people indoors who traditionally were not coming indoors with the congregate shelters offered in their communities. The second reason is this offering of healthcare. There have been programs across the state where there have been linkages of healthcare services to people experiencing homelessness, but they're often been on a small scale. This was statewide. So PRK was one of the first kind of statewide programs to really infuse healthcare directly into emergency shelter. And anecdotally, from people experiencing homelessness and the providers who ran these facilities, there were real benefits. You had nurses in some communities on site 24/7. You have departments of healthcare, of healthcare services, of mental health, of behavioral health coming to these sites several times a week. And you also had providers making sure that people who needed healthcare were getting those referrals out to the community providers to receive that healthcare. From the participant standpoint, we talked to many people across the state where they recognized that they finally had the ability to get to appointments on time. One person said that when they were on the street, they knew they had a doctor's appointment, but they were really feeling embarrassed to go and wait in the waiting room because they hadn't been able to shower or get ready for a couple days. So they would intentionally miss their doctor's appointment because they didn't have access to normal things that, you know, people who have an apartment or a house have, meaning they were able to get ready. Also, this one woman mentioned that like she put her appointments scheduled in her phone and set reminders for herself to go to the doctors. But when she was on the street, she doesn't have access to regular electricity, so that phone was often uncharged. When she was in PRK, her phone was always charged, and she was able to get to appointments on time and stay in touch with her doctors. We heard other situations where people were finally able to access healthcare for chronic conditions that are often really hard to treat being on the street, such as diabetes. So we heard of this intentional infusion of healthcare into emergency housing that had real benefits. And then the third thing in terms of why we found PRK successful is this, you know, we were in a time where there was a lot of infusions of federal funding as well as state funding, and it was largely flexible on how communities could use that funding. So we had pathways out of this emergency housing of PRK into permanent housing for people. So not only PRK provided a place where people could stabilize, get healthcare, have three meals a day, have continuous wellness checks over the course of a day, build community, but then there was funding on the back end to transition people into permanent housing in communities. So I would say for us as an evaluation team, those were the three big reasons that PRK was successful.
You know, it can be difficult, even with the depth and breadth of data and research that can be done. It can't always paint a full picture. And I know that there were some challenges when it came to getting full information that you and the other researchers would be looking at. So what was some of the data that was hard to get a grip on or a view of? And how does that affect the overall picture of how this initiative worked or maybe didn't work in some areas?
So our intention at the start of the evaluation was to understand both the housing utilization and outcomes as well as the healthcare utilization and outcomes for the clients who use PRK. We set that intention, we set up research questions, and then it was our job to start trying to get that data from the state data sources. I think it's really hard right now to be able to get the statewide data from any source. And so there were a lot of data limitations on our end to be able to access that data. You know, all these data that kind of are beneficiaries within the state, they sit in different data systems. So the healthcare data sits in a very different data system at a different agency as the housing and homelessness data does. And oftentimes these data systems are protected, as they should be, by different legalities and data use agreements. And it oftentimes, when they're using different systems, the systems don't talk to each other. A lot of it is trying to figure out how to access the data. And then if you do have access to the data, to be able to figure out how to match the data across these different systems, because they do not talk to each other. They were created at different points in time. So I think that's a really big finding from our study, is that in order to really address the kind of reasons of homelessness, to really understand how people can get out of homelessness, to really understand prevention of homelessness, we really need to dive into these data systems that sit across different agencies within the state government to really match and pair these data up to really understand utilization of outcomes of services within kind of the healthcare setting, within the homeless services setting, but also safety net programs that the state operates and that the federal government operate.
California continues to work on how to solve the homelessness crisis. And Project Room Key, you know, was one option in this, you know, very specific moment in time. But with all that you and the other researchers looked at with this evaluation of this initiative, I think it can be very revealing on not just what the unhoused need and what worked for them, but what needs to be done on a policy level. So in that respect, what can be taken from Project Room Key and applied to now?
Absolutely. That's such a great question, Mary, especially for the day and time that we sit in looking at the homelessness crisis across California. So I think there are a few kind of global learnings of PRK when you kind of think of outside of the pandemic. The first is infusion of healthcare into our emergency shelters and interim housing settings. And some communities are doing this as a result of the learnings from the pandemic. But I think, you know, really understanding that healthcare plays such a significant role in someone's well-being and their healthcare status, and then being able to kind of stabilize and kind of reach an ability to live independently. So help really, really infusing healthcare into emergency shelter and interim housing. We spoke to one provider in Los Angeles, and he had operated interim housing sites for the past decade or so, if not longer. And prior to the pandemic, they didn't have any healthcare at their interim housing site. They tried to link, you know, participants and their clients up with healthcare in the community, but no direct healthcare on site. Then he oversaw a PRK site, and he just kind of sings the praises of the 24/7 nurses that were on site, not only in like troubleshooting and kind of treating healthcare conditions, but also just building a rapport with clients to make them feel supported. You know, he spoke about how the nurses would, not only be checking for COVID symptoms and making sure people were recovering from COVID, but also, you know, how are your diabetes? What's your blood sugar today? What does your blood pressure look like? Oh, let's get a new bandage on that wound. So really just building a rapport and trust among the clients there. So he just sang the praises of the nurses on site. After that PRK site closed, he's back at an interim housing space, and he doesn't have healthcare. And it's a world of difference that, you know, he doesn't have access to healthcare for his clients. Again, they're going back to kind of bringing in, you know, healthcare on site through mobile medic vans or other types of mobile clinics, and also just referring clients out. So I think the big lesson here from the PRK evaluation in terms of moving it forward in the system is making sure that there is healthcare on site, and healthcare can look different for different populations, whether it's addressing physical health, mental health concerns, behavioral health concerns, also whether you're operating in a single adult site or a families with children site. I think healthcare can look different there as well. So I would say that was the first big takeaway. I think the second big takeaway, and a lot of communities in California have retained a lot of the hotels and motels through various programs to operate within their homeless service system. But really understanding why PRK was successful and why people came indoors. And it was specifically around the autonomy, the safety, and the privacy. You know, traditional shelters, as they've kind of been illustrated in the past, you know, big congregate sites, you think about a warehouse, you think about bunk beds, you know, there have been some sites that have been upgraded across the country to kind of be more cubicles and give some semi-privacy to people. But really with PRK, people have had their own rooms. They were able to close the door and lock the door and feel safe inside. They had access to their own individual bathroom. And they didn't have to worry about other people, coming into their space. So I think really understanding that this model was successful because we respected people and their wishes. They wanted to be safe. They wanted to have autonomy. They wanted to have privacy. And then they were able to bring in their partners, their pets, and their possessions into a room that they can close the door and lock it if they wanted to. So I think really understanding the role that hotels and motels across the state have in addressing the homelessness crisis. And as I said, some communities across the state have retained the hotels and motels from PRK. There's another program called Home Key, where they have retained these hotels and motels to serve as interim housing or transition and rehab the site into permanent housing for people. Those are two of the big kind of takeaways. I think another takeaway is just understanding the data, as we touched on, across the different systems in which the data sit across the state, and really making connections and linkages and having different state agencies create these data use agreements between different agencies to link the data, match the data up, to really understand the pathway of a person and what resources they are accessing or not accessing that are available to them.
In Depth will return after a moment.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
And for another perspective on these findings, we turn to Sarah Hunter, director at the RAND Center for Housing and Homelessness and senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on In Depth and getting into this conversation with me.
Great to be here. Thank you.
With this evaluation being out there and they've determined from what they've looked at, for this Project Room Key to have been a success. So from the work and research that you do and the perspective that you have, what are your thoughts on some of the overall findings there? And is it a success like they've determined?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think it's, where do we put the goalpost is really the issue at heart. And what I mean by that is, like, what do we mean by success? Like, how are we going to assess success? So if we define success as getting some of the most vulnerable people off the streets and into interim housing, yes, Project Room Key was overwhelmingly a success on that outcome. But did it prevent a massive wave of COVID infections and deaths? I think we don't really know the answer to that because we don't have a comparison. We don't have the counterfactual to draw upon. They didn't look for that. And that what I mean by that is, what if we did nothing? Like, what would have happened? We don't really know. If we think the outcome is we stably house people experiencing homelessness, I think we have really mixed evidence to that extent. But I don't think that was really the ultimate goal of Project Room Key.
So then with what you were just saying there, what was the best aspect for you looking at Project Room Key, and what were things that maybe didn't work as well if this were to happen again, if we had a situation like this where emergency shelter situations needed to come into play? What can be learned from having this sort of data overview of Project Room Key?
I think, this was a, testament that the state mobilized resources very quickly, and with the right intentions, we can mobilize and stand up an interim housing system very quickly. And so that, that points, I think, to another success of Project Room Key. However, we don't have the ample resources to continue to operate interim housing settings at this scale, nor do we have the resources to then exit people from these programs into successful, stable housing. Researchers found only about 1 in 5 at best, because there was missing data as well, ended with a permanent housing solution at the end of their stay in Project Room Key.
Yeah, and I think the data that was unable to be collected plays such a significant role there, and it ties into one of the major recent aspects to this continuing homelessness crisis conversation that we're having in California, is that whether we are looking at how something like Project Room Key worked or other initiatives that have, been happening since, so much money has been poured into solving this crisis. And yet, a lot of people are saying, what is there to show for it? Where is that data? Where's that money going? Do you think that there are reasons why it's so difficult to monitor those progressions that cities and counties in the state are, trying to put forth when it comes to homelessness? And how much of a problem is that for trying to solve this crisis?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think it's an absolute critical issue that is now just growing. Because, at the end of the day, we're talking about our taxpayer dollars at work. And everyone, therefore, has a stake in the outcome of these programs. And we all deserve some transparency and accountability. And that's been lacking. Just to put a little context around this evaluation, it was supported by philanthropic dollars, which is honorable. I'm thrilled that philanthropy has, have a seat at the table and want to do something about this. But it also speaks to the need for government buy-in. We need government buy-in to perform rigorous evaluations. And that means their support and resources to share data. and support the collection and management of data. So, you know, they point to legal hurdles in this report, which I think are inexcusable. This kind of data sharing can and should happen. And it does happen all the time in other sectors. So I don't think that's a good explanation. We need to fully support the resources needed to perform rigorous evaluations of these programs. That means data analytic expertise at the state, county, and service provider level. They need to engage, it appears, the legal experts to better understand that, you know, data sharing for evaluation purposes is critical. And we're talking about taxpayer dollars. We need to have oversight and accountability. You know, for example, I've worked in LA County. They have a chief information office, and they can, you know, find an individual in the data set and match that data across different services. That includes the homeless management system, the healthcare system, the criminal justice system, and track a person's use of these services. And we've actually used those data to perform rigorous evaluations in the past. It can be de-identified so that outside entities can use. So, you know, it appears there's a lack of capacity within the government to use these data for these evaluation purposes. So I think that's critical that they buy in to not only supporting the services, the direct services to the people in need, but to a rigorous data analytic approach, so we know what's being done with these service dollars.
You know, as we've kind of pointed out in this conversation, you know, there were things that worked with Project Room Key, and then there were aspects that we can't really get a good view on. So what's next then when we are addressing the homelessness crisis in California? We see things that work. We see things that don't. It's having the resources seems to be the biggest hurdle. So how do we get over that hurdle from your perspective?
Well, I think we need to have a better sense of knowledge about what's working and not working. So we need to allocate more resources to data collection, data analytics, data sharing. So we have a better sense, like even in this Project Room Key report, I have no idea who did well in Project Room Key and who felt, you know, who didn't. Like, what are the demographic characteristics of the people who stayed in and who didn't stay in? That wasn't, they didn't even look at that, let alone, you know, the lofty goals they had to combine it with these other system data to look at broader questions about use of other services. So I think we need to invest in the data analytics system to better learn from all these initiatives underway. We're doing tons of, and I think probably great work, but we don't have anything, we have no way of showing that because they haven't invested in that infrastructure. So, you know, in my work talking to nonprofit service providers in LA County who do this good direct service work, their budgets, they are so shoestring. And there's this emphasis that all the money needs to be spent on direct services. And so they don't have the data analytic infrastructure in place to actually monitor what they're doing and provide, you know, good data about their efforts. So I don't have, you know, good thoughts about what's going to come out of these audits. I think it's going to be really challenging because it's being done retrospectively, and just knowledge about, you know, what kinds of resources are on the ground to track. It's not impossible. It just, there needs to be more focused support and attention to it.
Thanks for listening. For KCBSN In Depth, I'm Mary Hughes.
You've been listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.